The Six Realms, like I said, with several people dying in the Sims Sangha, and plus, a lot of people, all these conversations, like, well, what happens, how to approach, how to think about those people, how to pray or do what. A lot of conversations going on. There have been a couple of memorial services, and it's just, it's in the heart, and it's part of the aging deal, 77, feeling it, and so we all know. And the question of dying and aging and all that, the Buddha continually taught about. But he also taught about the six realms or the five realms in terms of essentially a description of where a continuity of consciousness might appear, human realm being one of them. And I've seen statistics, and I think I saw that like 70% of Western Buddhist practitioners are not convinced in rebirth. I get that, and I'm kind of on the fence, or not on the fence, on some process. But you come out of some sort of tradition where you're supposed to believe in stuff for which there was no proof. Plus, people are individualistic thinking kind of people, and Buddhism has a whole quality of just show me to it, which works for all of us. So, totally get that. And to be sure, having conviction about rebirth and the six realms isn't necessary for practice. Practice works. Mindfulness works. Compassion works. We grow. So it's not necessary. And Stephen Batchelor has written a book about Buddhism without beliefs. And he's in the camp where he's not convinced, even though he was a monk and lived around Tibetans. So whatever. We won't really know until we die. Totally get that. Won't really know. But opening to some at least sense of the possibility of rebirth, whether we look at it literally or metaphorically or somewhere on the continuum, can be really useful in terms of our practice and kind of how we work with the journey. Because one of the reasons is, as many of us have been practicing for decades, and here we are getting on in years, and the possibility of awakening, becoming an arhat in this lifetime can seem a little difficult or not so sure if we'll make it kind of question. But if we turn it into multiple lifetimes, then it's a whole different ballgame. And we're working on a long, long, long journey. So I offer that as a way it might be useful to at least consider that, at least as a metaphor, or open to it, see where it takes you. I'm not trying to talk anybody into rebirth, because I really want to talk about the six realms and how we can use those, and just to get a sense of what they are. So, like them, not like them, whatever, but to work with them. So the Buddha did allude, one more rebirth thing, did allude to rebirth many times in the suttas, such here in the Digha Nikaya 33. He says, there are five destinations after death. Hell, the animal womb, the realm of hungry ghosts, human beings, and devas. And that's a Theravada take. There being five. Tibetan take is there's six. And the difference is the devas, from the Tibetan point of view, there's what's called asuras. So there's devas who are kind of in the god realm where they've, we'll be talking about it, but everything is perfect and happy and delightful, and the asuras are jealous and trying to, so whatever. But they're in that same arena. Whether you compress it to five or six, it sort of doesn't matter. So I want to, just do an exploration of Buddhist cosmology. It's worth having a sense of how it is, and do what you will with it, okay? And I'm offering as partly from, I had the great privilege of having some teachings from Tenzin Palma. Some of you may know she wrote, she didn't write, Cave in the Snow was about her. She's a British nun who spent 12 years in a cave in the Himalayas, and she's just extraordinary. She's like one of these incredible forces of nature kind of nuns. I mean, she's just so fiery and smart and kind of outrageous, and she's so cool. So she did a teaching. This is in it was in 2017. It was McLeod Ganj, because the Tibetan Nuns Project board was there for the 30th anniversary of Tibetan Nuns Project, which was a big deal, and so she ended up doing this teaching up at Tushita. So it was pretty cool. With all kinds of Western persons, you know, kind of backpacking Buddhist kind of persons all gathered, and some Tibetans. Oh, by the way, the Clear Mountain, in terms of attendance, the Clear Mountain monks have interviewed her twice, and she just loves them. It's just the second one was just so damn cute. So if you're interested in her, that's one really interesting way to get a sense of who she is. Just go on YouTube and look for Tenzin Palmo and check out those interviews, because they were pretty cool. So I'm going to quote a bit from her teachings in this, from that particular thing, because she's a very highly realized being, just an extraordinary being. And I'm also going to do something I've never done before, which is, you may notice that I got paper here, because I'm going to share a screen so you can see what I'm... Oops, there we go. That almost worked. Get over there. There we go. Talking about. Let's try it again. There we go. Bingo. So here we are. This is a Tibetan Tanka, a drawing of the six realms in the Tibetan point of view. But it's really, even though Theravada doesn't do stuff like this, which is why we're using a Tibetan one, and we're just going to pretty much think of it in terms of five realms, because this is the Theravada sharing. But the Tibetan imagery is, it's universal. It doesn't really matter, except for the very friendly-looking god of death there. So, and Buddhist cosmology is indeed based on the idea of rebirth, which in terms of vernacular is worth distinguishing from reincarnation. Because reincarnation, the word means that there's a soul, a self, who reincarnates. Rebirth is a much subtler question about a subtle mind stream continuing and appearing in multiple ways, which, if the six realms are true, would make a lot more sense, because if one of us became or has been an oxen, how could we couldn't have the same personality and mind and everything. So, and rebirth is connected to karma, the understanding that actions of body, speech, and mind, they affect the qualities of the subtle mind stream. In fact, that's the one thing that carries on from this point of view, is these qualities of the mind stream created by the actions of body, speech, and mind that we take. So this, from this springs the idea that we're going, you know, from a Tibetan Buddhist, they articulate it, you have infinitely many lifetimes, every being has been your mother, because we've had infinitely many lifetimes and every being's been your mother. And we've gone on and on and on and on. So we're practicing to not be just thrust along in this, to free ourselves from it and maybe even come back to help. The Buddha said in AN 334, the Miracle Discourses, he said, any karma fashioned through hatred born of, this is just an example of how karma drives us. Any karma fashioned through hatred, born of hatred, caused by hatred, originated by hatred, ripens whenever, wherever the individual is reborn. Wherever that karma ripens, it is there that one experiences as a result, either in this very life, or in rebirth, or in some quitting. So it's just a sense of this is all being driven by karma, all being driven by the qualities of what we do. And if you think of it in a way, if there is this subtle mind stream of us, and the very quality of the subtle mind stream would be affected by how we are and the choices we've made. And, you know, if we're being very greedy, there's a darkening. If we're being very kind, there's a lightening. And if we die, that's the one thing that would continue from this point of view. So, you know, in terms of me, I mean, I get it that we don't know. I'll find out about it when I die. And I will say that here in the early 21st century, some of you know I have been exploring NDE stuff a little bit and went to the online to the conference in Chicago just in August, much to my surprise. I thought we were going camping, but we didn't. So I signed up real quick and went. And that was the 50th anniversary of the coining of the term NDE by Dr. Raymond Moody. And what I got from that really struck me was that all of the heavy hitters in this, the leaders, they were all either doctors or scientists. They weren't like kind of goofy new age people. They were all doctors or scientists for one reason or another, stumbled upon all this evidence and go, oh my God, what's going on? I keep encountering people who are describing the same NDE. That's what Dr. Raymond Moody does. He's a doctor. He's actually trained in philosophy also. And there was a an articulated consensus by several of these people who have published peer-reviewed papers in regular journals, you know, medical journals about this, as well as IANS publishes them, but saying they feel like there's a tipping point where the accumulation of evidence is nearing a point where there'll start to be acceptance in the scientific world that there is continuity of consciousness. We'll see. But that was pretty interesting. I mean, these are scientists and doctors. These weren't, you know, flower children. So we don't know. But as a journalist, I've gotten more open, personally. And, you know, like all of us, looking death in the face, I'm probably a little closer than a lot of you, but here it is. So this wheel of life has a lot of metaphoric power to help us understand the path and help us navigate this journey, kind of put some traction into it. So we can look at it, I'm going to look at it mostly metaphorically, but you can transpose wherever you want. If you want to get more literal, go for it. If it just want to stay metaphoric, it's all good. Just whatever works for you. But you look at it, it's showing this cycle of existence and continuity going on and on and on, having to do with ignorance, having to do with the very phenomena that the path is taking us away from. If you look at the beginning, that's the god Yama, the god of death, holding this whole cycle of life. And this is, you know, sort of the message, fierce, right? This is serious business, not to be taken lightly. This whole question of life and death and how we navigate it. It's a big deal. The choices we make, they certainly drive our situations in this lifetime and maybe future lifetimes. So it's worth paying attention. So the Buddhist path, you know, it offers us freedom and equanimity and love and all these positive aspects, but it's also realistic in terms of the consequences of choices. And, you know, we learned that if we work on the side of not clinging, work on the side of mindfulness, work on the side of compassion, there's a brightening in our lives. And if we go the other way, there's not. And if, in fact, we're going on and on and on, then that gets, you know, more serious. So every wheel has an axis. And in this case, you know, isn't that cool? So I don't know if you can see that online. Does that work? You see it blow up? All right. So in the center is the three poisons. That's driving the whole thing. A bird, a snake, and a pig. And they represent three aspects of us which cause our attachment. So they're called the three poisons. The bird represents attachment or grasping. And for most of us, that may be a prevalent kind of condition. You know, grasping is often the strongest. So think of the image of the bird. It's always pecking. It's always seeking. It's always trying to get stuff, kind of repetitive way. And think about us, you know. When's the last time you were in some place where we are like that? What would it be? I don't know. Being around fast, attractive clothes or whatever, you know, whatever other gender, whatever gender attracts you the most, whatever. Having that kind of grasping energy, kind of like that bird. And that's when we do that, we concretize a sense of self around it. Because there's me wanting that comes up. And we can see this little part of us gets kind of graspy, kind of wants it. Next is a snake, which represents aversion. And again, it's metaphoric because there's nothing wrong with snakes. But, you know, they're prone to attack and striking out in many cases because that's what snakes do in order to survive. But we look at that part of ourselves that envisions other and then attacks it in order to get the good stuff for ourselves. It's part of what, it's an aspect of most of us. And then the third of the trio is pig. And whatever we may think of the intelligence of pigs, you know, in the conventional self, it's one of the smarter animals. In this case, they represent ignorance. So it's not recognizing the nature of things, living without recognizing how things are. And it's not conventional ignorance, not knowing about facts and data, but ignorance not realizing the emptiness, the not-self, the impermanence of phenomena. Jetson Palmo says, ignorance means we do not see reality as it is. We constantly project a delusory view of how things are. The most central ignorance is of an unchanging I at the center of us. So there's that anatta again. Surprised how often that shows up, right? And we can think, you know, it's worth exploring, like, you know, what of those three, what might be the strongest for any of y'all? You know, my wife and I have discussion, and she's more the aversive type, and I'm more the greedy type, and it's kind of when we sort of outed ourselves, it's actually helpful in watching ourselves do our dance, and we can kind of, oh yeah, you're doing that, right? It's, oh yeah, here I am again. So it clarifies how much these three actually are at the hub, at the axle of this whole wheel of samsara. But it's not inherently you. It's conditioned, not inherently us. It's conditioned. This is lifetimes and lifetimes of conditioning from this point of view, or maybe just also stuff in this lifetime. But so it's all changeable. If it's due to causes and conditions, then there's a possibility of change, which is why we're on the spiritual path. Jetsun Pamo said, "The three poisons are not intrinsic to our nature. All problems are not our inherent nature, but due to the delusory nature of seeing things. The nature of mind is all pervading, but we don't recognize it." So this is a really helpful, you know, that's why I wanted to share this and it would be helpful. It's really helpful to think about this just as a way to grasp just how central this is to the whole predicament. The next circle out, you can see it here, it's black on one side, white on the other, refers to karma. And in brief, the notion is that karma is the link between the three poisons. The three poisons have us act, body, speech, and mind, in ways that generate karma, because the word karma means action. So from the impetus of the three poisons, we do stuff. And it doesn't show it, so I thought a different one showed it better, but the way this works is on the dark side, it's moving downward with negative karma, and on the light side, it's moving upward. Not so obvious with this particular version, but that's the idea, is that karma, you know, takes us into more difficulty, more grasping, or lifts us up, depending on what we choose to do. This is a demon leading a human down. This is the demon leading a human down into the lower realms, and on this side is a bodhisattva leading beings up to the higher realms. So the whole point is kind of fluidity and cause and effect. And the more we really get our hearts around that fluidity of who we are, then that makes the whole journey of the spiritual path much more accessible, something we can really work with. Because we really kind of get more and more realize there is no static stuckness anywhere. There's nothing, you know, wrong with us, period. It's just not like that. There's conditions, but there's nothing wrong with us. Jetsun Pamo said, "Everything that is happening can change. Karma is very fluid, changes moment to moment." Okay, now let's go to the three realms, or the six realms. And in brief, there are three lower, three high. Let's see, how do we do this? Maybe I'll use this. There you go. There's the hell realm. Can you see the little hand? Can you guys see that? Okay. Hell realm down here, animal realm here, hungry ghost over here. Oh, you know, I use a different one. That's okay. And then, is that right? Not too tricky. Yeah, I thought this one actually showed it better. Okay, thank you. You're the man. All right, Eric. It does, doesn't it? Yeah, and you can see. Thank you. And this does show, just to get back to the karma thing, you can see how in this case, they're just plunging down there into darkness, right? And in this case, they're rising up. So thank you. Okay, so now it's a little bit flipped around backwards, but that's okay. The three lower realms are animal, hell, and hungry ghosts. I will. I'm going to talk about more. I'm just sort of giving you an overview. Is that okay? Yeah. And then up here is human, devas, and asuras, or you can put these together and make it one, depending on how we do it. So, you know, and a lot of us, I don't know how I won't push you on it, but some of you might maybe think, oh man, this is crazy stuff. I don't want anything to do with this. It's just, I like Theravada practice, simple mindfulness. But Buddha did teach this. He didn't teach it with these vivid colors, but he did. And for many of us, the whole idea of hells especially sounds like Judeo-Christian cosmology we thought we left behind. So it's kind of hard to even think of. And, you know, to be sure, no one's found any physical thing down there that would be like that, no miner or astronaut. So what exactly does it mean? Where is it? On terms of these, I don't know. It's a short answer, I don't know. But think of one way to think about it is just imagine if there is continuity of consciousness, if after we die from this body, there's something that continues. And just imagine what if any of us were in a situation where all the physical stuff that we ground ourselves with was gone. We had no body, we had no church, we had no home, we had no friends, we were just our mind state floating in an energy field. So in that case, what we've been generating could manifest in all kinds of imaginative, scary ways. And that may be part of what's going on in these realms, especially the non-physical ones. We'll talk about that. I hear you. Well, let's talk about that. There you go. There's some animals seems pretty good, some kind of hard. Let's talk about it. Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. Thank you. We'll get there. Any thoughts, by the way, before we proceed? Okay. So let's start with the hell realms. I was going to go walk through them. And if you get into the hell realms can be just, if you read about them, oh my God, huh? Oh my God, they're terrible. I mean, I thought it was only in Tibetan Buddhism where it's just ridiculous if you get into the hell realms. But actually, you can find it in Theravada too. It's like, holy smokes, you know, it seems so much like Harmonious Bosch, as I hear pronounced, you know, those depictions in the 15th century of Christian hell realms. And there's hot hells and there's cold hells and there's all kinds of, you know, things, and there's places where, you know, all your skin gets ripped off and then you reconstitute and then it gets ripped off again, and there's clanging copper plates and being boiled. It just goes on and on and on. Pretty nasty. So I don't know what to think, but at least if we're in a mind of hatred, that's kind of like that, at least metaphorically. It'd be a good reason not to be like that, because you look at how that manifests. Jetson Pommel calls this projections of very distorted minds, is how these lower realms are in particular. And you know, if we're not grounded by physicality, I mean, I wonder that sometimes about, and I'm not going to get political, but any persons that seem like they're acting in a very negative way, but somehow they're okay. Adolf Hitler, you know, he was what he was saying, and he died in a bunker. So that didn't work out too well anyway, but what about after? Assuming the aspects of him that were negative, what about after? I'm not saying he got thrown into a hell realm, but if that was his mind quality, that might be the universe he was in. Jetson Pommel said, when we die, because we leave our bodies, what we project is more concrete. We have no control, which is why it's so important to do this work now when we do have control to make choices. And this kind of just, I think this work kind of just polishes a mirror and gives us more clarity, a way to sort of embrace and work with the qualities of mind and the actions that we're taking, and how they could ripple out into the universe. I've been finding it really, really helpful. So if hell realms are endless hatred, the hungry ghost realms, which are over here, they reflect a minds of endless greed. And thank you, Eric, because this is the one I wanted to show. If you can see, this is a pretta here. Right over here, a classic pretta with a little thin neck and a great big belly. And especially, I think it's a Tibetan word, but you can see all through here, there's these big-bellied, thin-necked creatures who basically are beings who basically are hungering. They're ravenously hungry, they want, but they can't get enough to feel satisfied, and they're stuck in that condition for huge amounts of time. And it said even when hungry ghosts do find food, then it burns their throats, so even swallowing isn't satisfying. They're always wanting, they never get enough. And to what degree, this is something I don't know about, but you know, there's a lot of stuff about ghosts, you know, ghosts and graveyards. To what degree they are sort of like pretas and hanging around because they want something is an interesting question. So there may be a crossover between our sort of Western sense of ghosts and what these are. But it does really, it kind of embodies that whole graspy aspect, clinging aspect, which is really kind of the most vivid aspect of the three poisons that really drives our attachment. So, you know, can we see the hungry ghost in ourselves? It's worth looking at as part of our journey. See what we see. What about, you know, what about Black Friday and how people are at the mall or something? And you can see this narrowing of mind. You watch, you know, I've watched on TV, and it's like, oh my God, what is going on there? You know, this narrowing of mind, or maybe, you know, I mean, my wife and I got rid of our TV, so it's made life so much easier. But once in a while, I flip on a TV, and it's like, holy smokes. I mean, the ads are just crazy trying to get me to want things. They even say they're like cravalicious and they're craving. They use the word in a lot of ads, which is pretty, at least they're honest. So you can see how much this is a part of what we're up against. And look at how it colors our mind and heart when we yield to craving, when we're obsessed with craving. And then if we ended our lifetime, we'd kind of be like that, if that was a primary part of who we were. So it's a way good idea to, you know, the ethical aspects of the Dharma, the kindness aspects, they move us away from that, which is really good because we don't want to be there. But it's worth, you learn. There's a guy named, there's a lot of, as you probably know, there's a lot of Buddhist-oriented addiction recovery programs, and Vince Cullen leads Hungry Ghost retreats internationally because that's such a part of the reality for people that are struggling with addiction issues. Now, the animal realm. They can be. Yeah, I've been around some really addicted people. Man, they can feel like that. Just, they need to get that thing. Yeah, it's intense. It can be really intense. So it's all a continuum, you know. Until we're Buddhas, we're a little bit like that too. But you can really see it crystallize with someone that's got a really intense, intense addiction thing going on. So the animal realm, and I'm glad you brought that up, it's complex, you know, because our sense of the condition of animals is so conditioned by the animals in our lives. And yeah, Bonnie's got her cat there, was so happy in her lap, and we have a cat. So we kind of think, gosh, being an animal wouldn't be half bad because we'd be all taken care of and warm and fed. Well, that's like the utter exception. That's like the top pinnacle of cushy animal life, is being loved in a house and being warm and fed. Most animals, you look at what they're doing. I mean, when you're eating, it's always watching out to see who's going to attack it. And fish are constantly eating each other. That's what fish do. And all the seafood, the whole food chain, everybody's eating everybody else, just all trying to escape from each other. And then think about, you know, the industrialization of domestic animals. I did some research. There's 1.5 billion cattle in the world, more than half of which are raised to be killed. And there's about 1 billion pigs for the same thing. So that's like unbelievable. And many of these beings, they're like, you know, they're born in a prison, they live in a prison, they die in a prison. It is not good. You know, we've done all this horrible stuff. I remember seeing this, something on YouTube or something about in China. I think I mentioned this before, but it kind of caught my heart. In China, they're building these like pig raising high rises. They're like these massive buildings that are 7 stories high, just these huge things. And they start in the top and work their way down through the floors and then die in the bottom and they never get out of the building. And it's just, you know, giant trucks bringing food. And they had pictures of the workers there. And man, their energy was, it wasn't like they were being, it was just, it was hurting their hearts. They were killing, you know, and maybe that's what they had to do to feed their families, they thought, or whatever. Oh, it was really sad. And the animals were really sad. So Justin Palmer said, most animals are looking for food or to avoid becoming food. Female dogs in India don't live long. And but they have feelings and they suffer just like us, you know, when we have your cat, you know, or our both our animals are so sensitive. I mean, if my wife is hilarious, if my wife and I have even the slightest little edge between us, both animals get up and leave. It's like, come on, guys, you know. But they pick up on it like we're not fighting, we just said something vigorous, but boom, they're gone. So they're so sensitive, you know, and the thought of someone having to live in a prison like that kind of breaks your heart. So if we were in that situation, it'd not be so great, you know, if we were reborn that way. Who knows? Think what you want, but maybe so. That's certainly very clear in Buddhist cosmology. That's how it is. And they have this quality of not knowing. You know, think about in any of those three realms, if we were stuck in there, how would we get out? How would we do practice? How would we find out about the Dharma? How would we have any idea what to do? And we have enough trouble here. What about there? Can you imagine if you were, you know, born a horse? Then what do you, not that his horses are good. I know all horses are good, but how do you move on? You know, if we're all destined to awaken, how do you get out of there if you're in there? So then the upper quadrant, and again, you can look at this. Well, it's kind of interesting, and I'm sort of doing a more Theravada version of this. But the God realms, basically, and here the top is the God realms where everything is so nice. It's just, you know, not grounded in the body. Some good karma has brought you into the situation. It's just pleasant, 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 surrounded by whatever kind of undulating other gender or whatever it is you like, it's there, and all the best food and everything. So they can have delightful experiences for thousands of years. But the problem is that they have zero inclination to practice Dharma when they're up there because it's so nice. Why would they? And it's like a little bit like, you know, I don't know, fancy parts of this area like Mercer Island or Bellevue or you know, I can't remember, but those real extremely wealthy neighborhoods where it's really, really, really comfortable. And who would be inclined to practice the Dharma unless they really saw something clear? And so in a sense, depending on delightful circumstance is a prison because there's no inclination to get out. And if it changes, you have no equanimity to handle it. Jetson Palmo said, rebirth in the celestial realms is a spiritual dead end. It's very much self-indulgent with beautiful everything. A totally useless life. And you know how we are. We sort of turn towards a path when things are hard. And then if things are really nice, sometimes it's hard to remember. I sort of make a point sometimes when someone comes back from Kauai or Costa Rica or something like that. And ask them, but you can see. I'd say, oh, how's your Dharma? Oh, I didn't sit one time for that 2 weeks. You know, it's pretty universal. They forget because it was so much fun. Okay, fine. But we learn something from that. You know, we learn something from that. It actually is a wake-up call to how, you know, how we're dealing with pleasant and unpleasant. And if we're inadvertently seeking pleasant circumstance. I don't know if you heard that monk last night for the Wednesday night interview with the lamas. This German monk was just like, he was so funny because I loved him. He was just like, had a very ascetic existence in Thailand. Pretty much did tudong, wandering all the time. He was very funny, very upbeat, just laughing constantly. And he's been through all kinds of like brutal, difficult situations. Not brutal, but you know, difficult situations where there was no food and you were stuck and being rained on and all these kind of things. And he learned to not adhere to that and to find a whole deeper joy. It was pretty moving. I mean, you know, relative to that, I'm kind of, you know, a wuss. I mean, I'm a little attached to comforts, I know, but so it's really, really worth looking at. And I think this situation helps. And this is probably, I don't get too much, but the Asuras are down here in this one, and they're jealous of the gods. So they're shooting arrows and stuff, and they attack them. That's from a Tibetan point of view. But in a larger point of view, it's just a whole sense of beings who are in an upper non-physical arena. And the God realms, the other bummer about being in the God realms is that the karma gets used up, even though they're there for thousands of years or whatever. The karma eventually gets used up And there comes a time when it's going to end, according to the stuff. I've read this so many times. Comes a time when it's going to end. And that's supposed to be the worst thing, because they realize, oh my God, they start to get all wrinkled and stuff, and they start to smell, and people back away from them, and they're going to get dumped off into a hell room because they didn't do anything virtuous. They didn't actually remove any energy the entire time. So a lot of they go from there down to the hell realms because they basically were being selfish the entire time. So it's supposed to be the most painful thing. So compared to all that, the human realm, there we go, has the most possibilities. Because it's here, we experience the nature of conditioned phenomena. We can really grapple with what's pleasant, what's unpleasant, and try to stay conscious in the middle of it. We can get teachings. You know, it's can be unpleasant, but not too unpleasant, if we're so fortunate, especially like we are, where we're not actually in a war zone. But there's an opportunity to move ahead. And this is the best realm, because the other ones are in various ways pretty difficult to change anything from. Not so much. No, they're sort of stuck in a non-physical realm, so they're in the same boat as the devas. Yes, the humans. Humans are the ones with the opportunity. So, you know, I think this is here in the cluttered 21st century, we're doing the work. We're doing the work, and it's important. And this is for some of you, metaphorically, realistically, depending on whatever works for you, this may be useful. And by the way, out around the perimeter, which I'm not talking about, is the 12 links of dependent origination, which is where the Buddha talks about what the key part is, craving and clinging, but how all of this keeps us going around and around and around, lifetime after lifetime. So that's the 12 links on the outside. So, yeah.